Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, guest hosted by Ernie Svensson. Episode 31, Rebacchanalia.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL. And by GoToMeeting. Picture yourself on a phone call, sharing and explaining something visual with GoToMeeting. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/TWiL.
Hi, everyone. This is Ernie Svensson here for another episode of This Week in Law. Today, I'm substituting for our regular host, Denise Howell, who will be out this week, I believe, speaking somewhere in Northern California. I'm really excited about today's show for a lot of reasons, which I'll explain in a second. But first, I want to remind folks that we do the show live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern. So if you want to catch the show live, you can tune in on live at live.twit.tv. And again, that's every Friday. And for those of you who have tuned in live right now, remember you can jump into the live chat room at irc.twit.tv and also another chat room at friendfeed.com/TWiL, T-W-I-L, as in This Week in Law. And we often pick up some great questions from the chat room, so be sure to check out those forums if you want. So now let's talk about today's panelists. We have a new group of people in, or at least we've replaced entirely the usual crew. And the first person I want to welcome to the show is an old friend, Brandy Carl. Good to see you, or to hear your voice, because I can't see you.
Hi, Brandy. Ernie.
Yeah. And tell people where they can find you if they're looking for you online. You have Twitter and a website, I presume.
Right. I'm at Brandy K, B-R-A-N-D-Y-K. And BrandyCarl.com. That's K-A-R-L.
Okay. And you are a graduate of MIT and Boston University School of Law, and I believe you had practiced in the area of copyright, trademark law, and were you also involved in patent law as well?
No, I'm not a patent attorney. Okay. Yeah, I had my own practice in Boston for a couple years. Most recently, I was with Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society as a residential fellow. And right now, I'm a new mom, so I'm not working right now, but probably be back in the game soon.
Great. Well, congratulations on your new daughter, who you told us was 9 months old.
Her name's Allegra.
I love that name. I think that's just such a wonderful name. So yeah. Welcome to the show, and I
Thanks,
hope you're
Ernie.
As excited as I am to be here.
I am.
Next, we have Rick Clow, and Rick and I have known each other for a long time as well, mostly as a result of being among the first lawyers to enter the arena of blogging, I guess would be the best way to describe it. Is that right, Rick?
Yeah, I think we both followed Denise's lead about, almost 8 years ago.
I know. It was kind of, it was like, what's that old TV show, The Mod Squad? You know, you, me, and Denise were the first ones to enter this fray. Well, not the first, but, you know, the first ones to kind of look around and say, where are the other lawyers? So you graduated from the University of Richmond Law School, and I believe started the first online law review. Is that right?
That's right. Back in 95, we published the first issue of a student-edited law journal that was published exclusively online.
And from there, you decided that the practice of law was too exciting and you wanted to take a different path?
Yeah, the pace just wasn't for me. I wanted to slow down and go the tech route.
I
got my degree but have never practiced. I went the technology route from day one when I graduated in 96.
And you've been involved pretty much with so you started out involved with law and technology, right? Your first two jobs, as I recall, were with maybe the first one wasn't iManage or Interwoven, but that was one of the early ones where you did a document management for law firms, and then you went into contact relationship management software. Is that right?
Yeah, I was at iManage, was a document management company. That was actually after doing TrialNet, which did extranets for litigation management. And then was at Interface Software for a couple of years doing CRM for professional services. And have been on the internet path since then. I was at Social Text and then FeedBurner, which got bought by Google. And I've been at Google for the last 2.5 years.
And you're now the product manager of the Blogger team, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, welcome to the show. It's good to see you again, and I'm looking forward to talking with you and having you weigh in on all of these really cool issues that we're about to discuss.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And last but foremost, we have Gary Reback, who I'm very excited to have on the show. Gary is a very well-known lawyer in Silicon Valley and throughout the United States. The National Law Journal called him one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America, and that is no exaggeration as far as I'm concerned. He's best known for spearheading the efforts that led to the federal lawsuit against Microsoft in the late 1990s, and equally impressive, to me at least, is that he worked his way through Yale programming computers for the school's economics department. Is that right, Gary?
That's right, Ernie. It's great to be here. Nice to talk to you live.
Yeah, same here. You know, you sent me a copy of your book to look at, and we're gonna talk about this book because it's just a really fascinating book. I when I get books to review, especially legal books, I approach them with some trepidation because, of course, I'm interested in the law, but I would like it also to be really interesting and have some, you know, dramatic moves and so forth. And your book was one that I literally could not put down. It's a fascinating account.
Well, that's very, very kind of you. You know, it was hard for me to write. I've written all my life, but I've written as a lawyer. And when you write as a lawyer, people get paid to read what you write. It's a wholly different proposition to write, in effect, for a living. And my hat's off to the people who do that full time, because I just never could. One book really taxed my soul.
Yeah. Well, you did a really great job. I mean, I seriously recommend, I've recommended it to all kinds of people. A friend of mine who teaches a patent and copyright course in law school, he's going to use it with his students. Because I think there's so much in there. It's not just about antitrust. It's also about how lawyers think creatively and the kind of pressures they're under, both, you know, from litigation standpoint, but also from family pressures and business pressures. And your book answers one of the great questions, I think, of all time, which is, when is it permissible for a lawyer to ask a judge to enter an injunction against his own client? But we'll get to that later on. So for now, welcome to the show, Gary. It's great to have you here.
Thanks.
So the first question I want to ask you is, because we are going to spend some time talking about antitrust, obviously, is what prompted you to want to become an antitrust lawyer? Is this something that was like a schoolboy dream, or is it something you sort of stumbled upon?
Well, you know, I really didn't know what antitrust was when I was an undergraduate. And to be truthful, Ernie, I wasn't sure I really wanted to become a lawyer. When I was an undergraduate, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I toyed with the idea of going to grad school, but the people I knew in grad school were kind of depressed, to tell you the truth. And academia struck me as a very difficult life. And so I went to my undergraduate advisor and sort of sheepishly suggested that maybe I should go to law school. And I asked her where people went to law school who really didn't want to go to law school. And for a while, I thought maybe I'd come out to California and go to Bolt, because California seemed like such an exotic place to me. But she said, no, the law school that you want to go to, the place that people go who really don't want to be lawyers, is Stanford. So that's what I did, and I came out to California.
I thought it was Yale that lawyers went to who didn't want to become lawyers.
I think that's more popular these days, that's for sure. You know, I only really discovered antitrust law when I was a law student. As an undergraduate, I was interested in economics, and I got interested in computers because the university gave me a job to help me get through college, and that job was programming a mainframe computer because there were no personal computers in those days. So I was interested in economics and interested in computing, and when I got out to Stanford, there was a professor, turned out to be a very important distinguished professor, a guy named Bill Baxter, who became head of Ronald Reagan's antitrust division, and he really got me interested in the discipline, and so I've been in that ever since.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I took an antitrust course in law school only because the professor who was teaching it was very good, and otherwise, I mean, I really had no interest in antitrust whatsoever, but I figured he was good enough that anything he taught would be better than something else taught by a professor I didn't like as much. And I wound up being fascinated. I mean, it really is an interesting area, and it's not as much about the arcane elements of law as you would think. It's more about economic policy, and there's just a lot of sweeping questions. To me, it's a really fascinating area, and your book really captures that very well. And now your book is called Free the Market, and you obviously wrote this book to convey what you believe to be a very important message. And it's one, from what I gathered, that you believe isn't limited to just lawyers. And it opens with a very interesting quote, which I'd like to read. The quote is, "It will remind everyone, some conservatives painfully, that a mature capitalist economy is a government project. A properly functioning free market system does not spring spontaneously from society's soil as dandelions spring from suburban lawns. Rather, it is a complex creation of laws and mores." And what I find really fascinating about this is the person who quoted it was George Will. So tell us a little bit about this book and why you wrote it and what you hope readers will take away from it.
You know, I found that George Will quote while I was just thinking about writing the book. And it seemed to encapsulate everything I wanted to say in about two sentences. You know, when I started writing the book, the conservative way of looking at things was still ascendant. But it seemed to me that even among conservatives, they had departed from the kind of fundamental principles of competition that were so important to Bill Baxter and to other people who were in control in the 1980s. So as I started the book, to try to convince people who were already in the field that they weren't paying enough attention to competition. Now, as time went on, as I was writing the book, the economy got worse and worse. And I could never have predicted how bad it would get. But by the time I finished my manuscript, things had changed dramatically. And I knew that the administration was going to change and the world was going to change. And as I had written the book, as you said, I kind of directed it to people who weren't really interested in antitrust law, trying to explain to them that this was so very important to so many things that they did every day. And if they don't pay attention to it, bad things are going to happen. And so it's really kind of a plea for smart people of all kinds, like the people on this show right now, to get more interested in this area and to participate in it. Otherwise, decisions are going to be made for you that you're really not going to like very much.
Right. Well, obviously, your book isn't going to appeal to one segment, and that would be the Chicago School. Is that right?
Yeah, the Chicago School is a body of economic thinking that started, I don't know, in the 1960s, maybe even before that. It became associated with the University of Chicago and a number of Nobel Prize-winning economists who came from that area. And there were lawyers who didn't really work at the University of Chicago, but became known as Chicago School advocates. That body of economic thinking basically suggests that the market will take care of itself, that the government has a very minimal role, perhaps no role at all, that the market will self-stabilize, that there's nothing really we need to do. And that role was prevalent. That viewpoint was prevalent during the Bush administration until the bottom dropped out of the economy. And then you saw even Alan Greenspan apologizing for that viewpoint, literally apologizing. These days, I'm told, you can't even find a Chicago School economist on the Chicago School, University of Chicago campus. So things have changed. But you're right. It's not directed to University of Chicago economists because I don't think they're open-minded enough to process the new information.
Well, I know we can find a Chicago School professor at UCLA because last week we had Doug Lichtman on the program, and he was great. It was really a fascinating, spirited debate. But I was kind of surprised because he took the view, for example, with the Betamax decision, if I understood him correctly, to say that it didn't allow for time shifting, which but more importantly, he said he didn't think that we needed the Betamax decision, that eventually time shifting would have come out and that everything would have been fine and we would have all had our TiVos and the world would be a wonderful place. I went back and listened to him debating with Fred von Lohmann from the EFF, and Fred, of course, is very articulate. And the phrase he used in connection with, you know, the need for spurring innovation in certain situations was market failure. He talked about market failure. Is that kind of what you're focusing on, is areas where the market, the free market, doesn't operate efficiently and the government needs to step in? And why is that especially important in the technology arena?
Yeah, first of all, let me just say something about Betamax. You know, if we hadn't had that decision, things would be very different, I think. And it was a 5-4 decision, and the good guys barely squeaked through at the end. So I agree with Fred's part of the debate. You know, more generally, though, the whole area of antitrust is not directed to just market failures. It's kind of the rules of the road. In other words, the theory of antitrust is that the government sets the rules of competition, like, as I said, the rules of the road. Then the government steps back and lets these companies duke it out, free market competition, and market philosophy prevails. And the people with the best product who sell at the lowest price, they're the ones, hopefully, who win in the free market. Now, as you've pointed out, we have a particular challenge in the high-tech sector, because the high-tech sector doesn't generally run the way the Chicago School imagines the economy to run. You know, in the agricultural sector, all potatoes are more or less alike. And you don't like potatoes because I like potatoes, or any of your other friends like potatoes. You either like them or you don't. But in the tech sector, you use products because your friends and acquaintances use products. You might use a word processing format because you want to exchange documents with me and with everybody else. So there are a set of economic conditions called network effects that are present in the internet, and they're present in desktop software. In some cases, they're stronger. In some cases, they're weaker. But those effects indicate that we've got to be particularly careful in the tech sector to catch anti-competitive behavior early on, because the normal forces of the free market will reinforce dominant companies instead of bringing them down.
Rick, do you have any questions that you want to pose to Gary or Brandy? Either one of you guys want to jump in here, because you guys know as much about this as I do and have as much interest in this arena of fostering competition in the tech world?
Well, I don't want to debate the straw man from a prior discussion, but I find it curious that there would be an argument that we didn't need Betamax in order to establish time shifting, because it seems like that was exactly what was needed at the time. It was not at all clear prior to that decision that the studios weren't going to be able to strong arm the technology companies into avoiding technology that gave people control over this content. I just noted in IRC, by the way, my favorite anecdote from the Betamax decision was actually Mr. Rogers' testimony, or in the he testified in that decision, and it, I thought it was compelling. I remember reading it as a law student and thinking, wow, that guy's a lot cooler than I gave him credit for. But he testified as somebody who produced his show and talked a lot about being opposed to people being programmed, being opposed to the rights holders controlling what people did with the content once they got it. And I think in a lot of ways that's set a number of precedents for how we in the tech business today, at least I know it's informed my own thinking on Blogger. You know, I look at my users' content and it's theirs. We explicitly even state that in our terms of service. This stuff belongs to you. You create it, you own it. We just have the right to reproduce it when people ask for it, which is what our service ultimately does.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it seems to me that this is a very strong example of where the law has become out of step with what people seem to expect. You know, people want to have access to information in many different ways, and they want to be able to move their music around if they buy it online. They want to be able to watch DVDs that they buy and not have to worry about what country they're in. And, of course, some of that implicates beyond copyright, and we get into just plain contract and digital rights management. But, I mean, is it your sense that the law has become out of step with what societal expectations are?
I'd like to take a shot at that, Ernie.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, copyright was a body of law that was developed in the era of conventional books and the printing press. And its theory is a good theory. In other words, that we need to give authors some inducement to create books. That was its underlying theory. Now, of course, we all of us now live in an age of rapid technological change, and that change has produced all kinds of corollary changes. There's much more content now. There are different expectations by authors as to what will happen to content. And so it's going to take copyright, I think, a little bit of time to catch up. And in the meantime, there are going to be conventional and traditional interests who are going to resist the kind of changes in the kind of viewpoint that we have here on the web. And so I expect there to be tension for, you know, a substantial period of time. Generally, over time, copyright has found a way to accommodate those changes. Sometimes it's by changes in the statute that Congress has to do. Most of the time, it's by changes in the case law, like the Betamax case. One section of my book is about the intersection between copyright law and antitrust law, and I use as an example a case that went to the Supreme Court in the 1990s involving Lotus and Borland.
Oh yeah, that is a fascinating account. I that should be made into a movie.
It's a movie that I don't know whether it would have a sufficiently happy ending or not to be. But there were a whole bunch of very colorful people and characters involved in it. But it sort of tested the limits of the kind of thing we're talking about here, which is that, you know, when these new technologies came along, the larger entrenched companies wanted to use copyright to block smaller, innovative startups from bringing product to market. And we had to go literally all the way to the Supreme Court to keep that from happening. Right. We face the same tension now in the patent law. But you know, copyright, I hope over time, will accommodate. But it's not going to be easy. And you know, those of you who live and work on the web are going to have to continue to push your viewpoint, because it's not automatically understandable to the people in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, the Borland discussion is truly fascinating. I really think that those couple of chapters are something that every law student should read for a lot of reasons. But there's included in it is all these wonderful ironies that, you know, Mitch Kapor, who founded Lotus, because, and he named it Lotus because he was a transcendental meditation instructor, he was opposed to the lawsuit against Borland, right?
Yeah, Mitch, you know, I know Mitch very well, and he's one of the great innovators of our sector. You know the way startup companies work. Eventually, the founder is kind of moved out and professional management comes in. And whereas Mitch believed in innovation as the way to propel his company, well, when the new management came in, they wanted to keep what they thought should be theirs. And they wanted to focus more on keeping people out of their space than on building new products and new innovations. So it was a difficult time, I think, for Mitch personally, because I think he wanted to speak out more. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but, you know, I think he wanted to speak out more. And he did speak out at congressional hearings, for example. But I know he felt a tension there.
Right. Well, that was one of the interesting points. The other thing, and this is interesting to me because I'm a litigator, as you are, is the strategy. And I alluded to this earlier, but at one point you ask Judge Keaton of, you know, tort book fame that all first year law students probably have used for years and still use. He's now a federal judge, and you asked him to enter a preliminary injunction against your client Borland. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a strange event. Judge Keaton, by the way, just passed away earlier this year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but it was a very tense 7 years in his court because, you know, he was a very smart man and a very accomplished man, but boy, was he stubborn. And when these early tech cases came to courts, judges couldn't resist the temptation to try to make all the law in one fell swoop. You know, they wanted to put their mark on copyright and software law and everything all in one decision. And he really went way too far. And he had a lot of personal difficulty retreating from his position. And the only way that I could get the case out of his court so that it could be heard by the Court of Appeals in Boston was literally to ask the man to enjoin the sale of my own client's product, which, as I point out in the book, he granted. I think it was the only motion I ever won in his court in 7 years. But happily, you know, we got it to the Second Circuit. Now, we had our own ordeal there. We had to argue the case twice because Judge Breyer at the time was appointed to the Supreme Court. So we argued the case. We felt good about it. We then got notification that Justice Breyer was going up to the Supreme Court. So we had to come back the next session and argue the same case. And meanwhile, of course, the client is bleeding cash. You know, the whole software industry is sort of stuck because they don't know what the rules will be. It was, you know, a difficult time for a litigator, as you might say. I mean, imagine what my blood pressure was during that period of time.
Well, and the storm, you know, it was, I mean, literally, it should be made into a movie because there are storms surrounding Washington. The federal government is under a shutdown because there's the economic, the budget battle. It's just crazy. It was crazy. The whole thing was just bizarre. But in the end, you won kind of a Pyrrhic victory, I guess, but you won on the tie goes to the runner because the Supreme Court couldn't reach a definitive decision. It was a 4-4 tie, and so you won based on the, you know, victory in the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, and I think the real test is that decision has become accepted. In other words, you don't see companies trying to use copyright law to prevent compatibility anymore. The tension in copyright has moved to some of the issues you were talking to Rick about earlier and some of the issues you've aired on this show from time to time. We still have a lot of issues about copyright and new technology, but thankfully software compatibility just isn't one of them anymore.
Well, what do you think? I mean, if you could wave a magic wand and change the copyright system, and I guess part of its problem was like the snake that swallows, you know, the rat, copyright was forced to swallow software and nobody really knew where it was going to fit. And then, you know, so they jammed it into copyright as opposed to patent law. I mean, is that the solution, or, you know, what do we need to do to fix copyright? Cause I assume you feel like it's not working optimally.
Well, yeah, I don't, you know, that's a very profound and difficult question. The parts that were working the worst did get fixed by Lotus v. Borland simply because there was sort of an agreement in the industry once the Supreme Court affirmed the First Circuit in Boston. So that part of it did get fixed. These new questions, though, you know, we had a new copyright law, the DCMA, that you've talked about before. There still continue to be problems. I think, frankly, there are always going to continue to be problems because in the tech sector, we're always going to be advancing the technology. People are going to think of new uses for content. We're going to increasingly see content as data that's being mined through search engines and through Twitter and through other means. And so I don't know that there's any easy way to do a fix, and I certainly wouldn't pass a law immediately, even though that there are, you know, very disturbing situations. I don't know that I'd pass a law immediately because I don't know that Congress can balance all the conflicting interests until the technology gets a little more, I don't know if stable is the right word, but at least the environment gets a little more stable.
So I'm going to jump in. I mean, I'll be the first to admit one of the reasons I went to law school was because there was no math. So the idea of me throwing out an economic argument is on its face pretty absurd. But it seems to me that this issue of copyright and some of the issues with it being broken are in part because what was being protected was the financial model around the incentives that needed to exist, right? We needed to create incentives for people to create books because it was expensive to create books. It was expensive to distribute books. And that there needed to be some way of controlling that. What I think we're seeing a lot more of today is ways to monetize the creation of the content that are both easier and the distribution of the content is often free or close to free, such that the incentives aren't necessarily aligned with the business anymore. And so I think the technology is getting farther and farther out in front of the law, such that people are getting more and more creative with how to monetize it, and don't see in copyright the same protection that it might have afforded a decade or two ago. Am I in the ballpark there, or is that going down the wrong path?
I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think alternative business models still leverage the copyright rights, and I'm not so sure that we should abandon the copyright system just because now in this moment of time we happen to be monetizing copyright differently.
Well, but so, you know, I don't know, Brandy, how much you've looked at the ongoing discussion on a site called TechDirt. Mike Masnick has sort of taken up the banner of this notion in the music industry of give fans a reason to buy and connect with those fans as an alternative way for musicians to monetize their music.
Right. So, the argument is, I see it all the time. Everyone says, you know, make money through concerts and merch, right?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think there's more to it. I guess I'm just questioning whether the model has to be monetizing the copyright itself, or if copyright is itself fixed to the distribution in a way that doesn't really apply right now.
I don't know. Obviously, I don't think anyone should foreclose alternative models. But again, I'm brought back to the copyright owner's rights and saying, well, if I want to monetize it this way, I can, and I have that right.
I think where I remember the last time.
I think we're on different pages here.
No, I don't know that we are. I think part of my challenge in when Congress has looked at this has been that they've tried to legally forbid certain technological abilities. Like I remember back 4 or 5 years ago, Fritz Hollings had a bill that would have criminalized the copying of content without the express permission of the rights holder. And that seemed to me to radically alter the balance where my understanding, and again, I'm now 15 years out of law school almost, and purely on the technology side these days, but you know, my recollection was copyright gave you recovery for damages when there was a wrong, but it didn't establish the ability for those rights holders to forbid the ability to do wrong in the first place, and remove from the landscape that ability before damages could even be inflicted. And that seems to not be to Gary's point. It's not a balancing. It's tilting in favor of one side of that puzzle.
Right.
On the flip side, I mean...
Is the default kind of we catch everything, or is the default we let a lot of these things slide? Obviously, what's better for innovation is setting the default backwards, right? Where more copying is allowed, there's no prior restraints on copying, things of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, one question, you know, the question I always, you know, ask, and I asked this of Professor Lichtman last week, or I wanted to drive the discussion here, is what is it exactly that we want to incentivize in copyright? This, again, you know, is echoing what Rick is getting at. Because if, you know, and how are we trying to incentivize it? Because, you know, because we are giving people limited rights and a certain level of control, which, you know, it's not completely free market. I mean, it just seems to me kind of strange when people who are pure free market people look at copyright and say, oh, you know, let's have strong copyright protection. Those two concepts seem to me to be somewhat incompatible, which is okay as long as what we're doing with that policy is encouraging something useful for society. Because society is the one that's losing out if the copyright holder, which isn't always, you know, the person who created it, is allowed to control the flow of that information. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and we certainly see that on Blogger. I mean, you know, one of the things that was in the prep notes for this show was our revision on Blogger to how we handled DMCA complaints. It was just a fundamentally broken model before. It wasn't good for users, nor was it good for rights holders. And revising how we handled those complaints filed by the rights holders and also trying to balance the interests of the users was a non-trivial undertaking. But I think where we ended up was in a much better place for everyone. So it's not that I take the position that there should be no control, there should be no law, there should be only unfettered copying because information wants to be free. That's not where I come down personally or in my role on Blogger. But I do want there to be a balance. And I think we're in a better place than we were a few months ago. I think where my frustration is where DMCA complaints get sent out by the same label that shared the link to the music so that the band could get more promotion, but that the marketing and the legal departments aren't talking to each other. So you've got the marketing departments getting bloggers writing about the band. And then 3 months later, the lawyer's sending out DMCA complaints saying, how dare you promote these files, and getting the bloggers' pages taken down. So there's a disconnect there that we see not infrequently.
Yes, lawyers are good at saying no and not good at saying yes. Well, Brandy, you highlighted a couple of good articles to discuss, and why don't we take up a couple of those? One of the ones I found
before Comcast kicks me off again. Skype; it was Comcast.
Well, let's not talk about your suggestion of the article on Comcast contractors getting caught disconnecting the competitor's service then, because...
Right, that's where I am right now in Panama City. They went around and it was the contractors that were selling the services, and there's a municipality that has a competing cable service, and they cut the lines. Amazing.
Yeah.
This reminds me of one of my favorite Paula Poundstone jokes ever. She was giving a concert and Sirhan was up for parole. And his statement to the parole board was that if Bobby Kennedy were alive today, he thinks that he would want Sirhan to be released. And Paula's joke was like, man, talk about bad luck. Of all the people that this guy would assassinate, it's the one guy that would say, set him free. I mean, the details in that, they disconnected the cable of the mother of the commissioner, who knew enough to stall him in their apartment until she got her son on the line, who was able to send the sheriff to get the guys arrested. Terrible luck.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. Well, there's another article. Another article I want to turn to, because I love looking for things that involve irony. And now we have the AP, you know, saying it's mad as hell, it's not going to take it anymore. It's building a new news registry to protect its content, which it, you know, obviously is entitled to do, I guess. But isn't that kind of ironic? Rick, you worked at FeedBurner. You understand news syndication. Perhaps you should chime in first.
You know, I've got a good friend of mine, a guy named Chris Thilk, who I thought came up with a great way of pointing out the difficulties in the path that the AP is heading down with this approach. Specifically that they're trying to put walls and barriers in front of their content. I understand that they are concerned about its distribution without their control and perhaps without compensation. But so he did a little experiment. And he, for a period of a couple of months, he rewrote all the links that he was sending to the AP on his blog through Bitly so that he could then track all the click-throughs of all the traffic he was sending to the AP on a weekly and monthly basis. And he calculated what each incremental page view to the AP was relatively worth on a rough estimate of what the RPMs would be if the AP were making decent money monetizing their own content. And he said, if they want to charge me a subscription, I'll just deduct the amount of money I'm generating for them every month. And then each week he was publishing the Bitly stats showing how much traffic. And he said, the point here is I and others like me want to be able to reference an authority on this content. And when we do that, and he's demonstrating with his own data that he is sending traffic their way, that the benefit to them far outweighs the barriers that they are trying to put in place. So in his case, he was demonstrating that it was at the very least a wash, that he was generating enough revenue in the data from people who were visiting the AP site from his site. And the redistribution, which I think is often an underlooked or underappreciated benefit here, is that other people who were reading Chris in Google Reader or re-syndicating the content themselves, that the clicks from Chris's site were always a subset of the total clicks generated from his link. I think barriers to accessing the content is not the way to go. Not if you want to be meaningfully in the middle of the conversations and the telling of the stories, which has traditionally been the AP's role.
Yeah. Well, I want to mention we have reacquired Gary Reback. Welcome back, Gary.
Thank you. The problem was on our end, so I apologize.
No problem. We didn't talk bad about you while you were gone.
That's good.
This whole thing is kind of, it's just, there's like a bunch of these examples where the incumbent person, copyright holder, has this advantage and tries to ward off competitors. The VCR appears and the recording industry doesn't like that, but it turns out, guess what, that this is actually a whole new market for them that they do really well with. And you see these sorts of examples throughout history. I think we're seeing them more often now. Does everyone get that sense as well? I mean, because of the pace of development of technology?
It's a mixed bag, I think, from the perspective of these incumbents. I mean, I don't think you could say that newspapers feel good about the way things are going. And I suppose that the AP feels like its existence is being threatened. I mean, I certainly can't argue their side of the equation, but in places where where companies have been able to adapt to the change in circumstances, and the VCR is a good example, and time shifting is a good example, they come out way ahead. And in places where they have a difficult time coming up with a new business plan, then they have a lot of difficulty, and that difficulty does march across society. I mean, the demise of newspapers because they can't come up with a new business plan is quite significant, I think, and it changes the way people in the future are going to acquire information.
Right. We'd like to pause for just one quick moment because Denise has pre-recorded a word from our sponsor. So take it away, Denise.
Hi there, it's Denise. I hope you're enjoying the show. I know I'm looking forward to listening when I get back from my travels. In the meantime here, I'd like to thank our sponsor, audible.com, twitter.com/audible_com, if you'd like to follow them there. Audible has been a longtime supporter of Twill and all the shows on the Twit Network, and we love, 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 love them. Love the material that you can find on their site, everything from lectures to books to all sorts of different kinds of audio. I was hoping to find a conventional book for you this week, because if you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you get a 14-day free trial of the Audible Listener Gold program, which entitles you to a free book. So we always like to make a suggestion for what you might check out among the 60,000 titles available on Audible. And with Gary Reback on the show, I was hoping to possibly point you toward his book, Free the Market, which is unfortunately not available on Audible. Maybe it will be someday, so keep an eye out for it there. Do check it out elsewhere, though. I wanted to find something complimentary, though, to Gary's book. And I settled on Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth by David C. Corton, narrated by Jonathan Davis. Mr. Corton thinks that the steps being taken to address the current economic crisis do nothing to deal with the reality of a failed economic system, and he thinks it's like treating cancer with a bandage. He makes some suggestions about creating a new economy that is locally based, community-oriented, and devoted to creating a better life for all. So do check out Mr. Corton's book. Thank you very much, Audible, for your support, and thank you for listening to This Week in Law.
Great. Well, thanks, Denise. We've lost Gary temporarily, so we'll bring him back. But one of the other things I want to turn to is an article you suggested, Rick, the Wikipedia work slowdown, augmented social cognition, a park group talking about population shifts in Wikipedia, analyzes a slowdown in editing activity on Wikipedia. So is this a natural slowing of the growth curve, or is there something else going on, Rick?
Well, so it was interesting. This was it happened on a thread internally at Google. We were kind of chatting about this the last day or so. And the reason I suggested it to you guys was late in the article. It's a blog post by the folks at PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center, Xerox. And late in the article, they're talking about the fact that fewer and fewer people are graduating from the casual editor group at Wikipedia into the frequent editor class. And that this upward mobility used to be a standard indicator of the health of the community that plotted over from like 01 to 07. There were a number of people that would go from being infrequent editors, 1 to 10 edits, into the 10 to 99 edits a month, and then the very frequent editors of more than 100 a month. And that growth almost stopped entirely in 2007. And has stayed flat to a little bit of decline. And they ask a question about this trend, and they ask whether it's evidence of the wiki lawyering barriers. In other words, saying that there's been increasing regulation within the community. It's not lawyering. It's not like a bunch of lawyers have shown up and formed committees to decide what to do. But it's an increasing self-regulation where decisions have been made about how easy it is to, in fact, edit content on Wikipedia. And this is an interesting challenge. I certainly see cultural issues develop. Blogger is a very large community of hundreds of millions of viewers of content a month and over 10 million people a month creating content on Blogger. We obviously have a very different mindset in terms of what the purpose of creating that content is. But I found this very interesting, and I don't know that I had a point or a larger discussion topic other than the implicit rebuke of this notion that social mores and some limited self-control is in fact bad for a community like Wikipedia.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give Brandy a chance to chime in if she wants to. To comment. Brandy, do you have any thoughts?
I don't know. This is not my area for sure.
Oh, okay. All right.
Is it bad that there's kind of social regulation of Wikipedia? Probably not. Does it replicate kind of the economics of large firms? I think yes.
Mm.
Right. On how large firms operate, even though none of these people, you know, there's communication between editors for sure, right? But it's not the same as an actual firm, right? But I think it's the same idea, is that it slows down. There's a lot of middle management. There's fewer upper management as time goes on with the growth of a large firm, right? So I think it mirrors that, and I don't think it's bad. I also think that it probably tracks just Wikipedia was new, and now it's not new, right? That it may just be a novelty phenomenon, that there were so many people moving forward in the editing classes, and now there's not.
Yeah, I think that actually could do a lot to explain. It has matured, and there's only so many times you have to edit the Wikipedia page on, you know, the 2004 presidential election before it's relatively complete and there's not going to be a lot of new information today, tomorrow, next week, next month. I think there's certainly something to be said for that.
Do you all feel, Rick and I, you and I have been blogging like since, I guess, about 7 years now. And it seems like when we first started, one of the really cool things was that people who were on the so-called right were talking to people on the so-called left, and we would link back to each other. And it seemed to me, maybe I'm, delusional, but it seemed like there was a really fresh, interesting dialogue that seems to have diminished. I don't want to say it's evaporated, but it seems to have diminished. I'm all in favor of the free flow of information, but I find this another interesting topic, that I would throw out to everyone, is that we have all these tools that allow us to talk in really interesting ways to one another, the internet being the prime example and the prime enabler, and yet we seem to have gotten bored with it and degraded, and we now are some people are trying to figure out how to control the conversation through copyright or whatever, and then sending cease and desist notices, and we really haven't found a way to use this in the way that I thought we would use it back in 2002 when I first started blogging.
Well, I will say my opinion on this has changed pretty dramatically since I joined the Blogger team. Blogger is a lot bigger than I think most realize. We reach over 300 million people a month, and over 270,000 words per minute are written on the product every minute of every day. There's been a larger increase in page views and users in these 8 months than there were in all of last year, and in even more than in 2007, which is all to say, not pat us on our backs, it's that these conversations are growing. And I think more and more people are using Blogger and Twitter and Facebook and others to communicate. In the more mature areas, legal is certainly one where there became a lot of lawyers in the 2002, 2003, 2004 timeframe who started blogging, law professors, law students, I think that's settled out pretty well. I think there's a pretty well-established community of people who are talking, some of whom are monetizing it, some of whom are just doing it because they love to do it. And other communities that haven't reached that same maturity level are still finding this as new and fresh as we did 7-8 years ago. So it mostly happens off of our radars, because unless I was running Blogger, I wouldn't have any reason to be looking at knitting blogs on a regular basis, or the mommy blogs, or the fact that Turkey is the third largest country in terms of page views on our product, and for a week they weren't able to reach Blogger. So all of a sudden those conversations died, and 2 days ago they resumed. Those people, it's a pretty critical part of their daily routine. So I don't know. I think the evolution of how these conversations are happening has certainly changed in some unexpected ways from when you and I started this a while back, but it's pretty vibrant today, much more so than I anticipated when I joined the team in January.
Right. Well, I wonder about something like Gary's book, for example, which is important social commentary. It helps people understand, this area of law that most would regard as arcane, and involving numbers, and that's why we didn't go to law school. And yet, he's out there, he's talking about this. This is something important. I don't know. Hopefully, Gary, are you still on the podcast?
I am on, yes.
So, mm-hmm. I wonder, after you've written this book and you've been talking about it, do you find that there's online commentary coming out to you, people reaching out to you, finding you on your website, and that you're able to have a dialogue about these sorts of things, or do you not sense that at all?
I think it's somewhat in between. If you take some of the communities that Rick identified, they've been active. For example, we talked about the Lotus Borland case, and there are other treatments in the book that deal with how intellectual property protection has affected libraries. Well, the law librarian started blogging that. And they got me involved in discussions, but mostly they discussed among themselves. And the, you know, the threads went on for days and for weeks. And it was very gratifying. And I didn't agree with everything that was written, but a lot of it I felt very good about. And I certainly felt good about the fact that there was a mechanism through which people could discuss the issues that I raise in the book. And there is an antitrust lawyer community that uses the internet. There are antitrust lawyers that blog. They're antitrust law professors. And many of them have commented on the book and on issues in the book. So, you know, Ernie, I would respectfully pat yourselves on the back a little bit. I think that there's a lot going on, and I think it's all for the good. And you know, before we had these technological capabilities, those kind of discussions could only occur in symposia where people literally all had to come to the same place. Those were expensive. They were difficult. They didn't occur all the time. They weren't open to everybody. And so this new technological world, I think, has been very helpful in propagating new ideas.
Do you find that to be true in the legal community as a whole as well? I mean, do you find that lawyers – because I hear, you know, when I came into the practice a lot, I'd hear the old timers say, oh, the practice's law has changed. It used to be great. Now it's horrible. And I'm, you know, now I'm sounding like one of them. Not that I'm going to say it's horrible, but things, there does seem to be a shift in how we talk about things, even as lawyers. And I don't know, you know, maybe, again, maybe it's just me. I'm down in New Orleans. I don't travel the country like you do. So, you know, perhaps I'm missing out on this larger conversation. But do you have a sense that the legal profession is changing in the way that it, you know, interacts among itself, or that it, in the way that it front faces society when society has questions that lawyers can answer?
Well, you know, Ernie, the legal profession has become far more commercialized, at least over the course of my career. And the legal publications kind of foment that. And the practice of law really has changed. And there have been interesting write-ups using New Orleans, for example, as a place where the change has been most profound, because there was a level of traditional collegiality in the practice of law. Information didn't travel as fast. There was a more laid-back attitude among lawyers, and a lot of that's changed. I'm not sure all of that is for the better, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure clients get better service as a result of the fact that lawyers run their operations more like a business than other things. But there has been that change. Information technology has been a part of that change. Not all lawyers use information technology the same way, but certainly the big firms do. They use it as much as they can all the time to get their message out. So that has been an important change.
Brandy, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think your original point about, you know, the right and the left talking to each other, that's not what I'm thinking of. But I think the way we talk about law and the way we talk about the practice of law is very different. I don't think people used to talk about the practice of law as much as they do now. And a lot of things, you know, were just not said in polite company or not said to one another, but all we have to do is look at above the law, and we know that things are very different than they used to be, right? We talk about the business of law, the economics, what's happening overall, and there's information sharing that there never was before. You didn't used to know the salaries of everyone and who got bonuses and who didn't, and now we do. Or the partners that blabbed about their firms going down the tubes on the DC subway system or whatnot. But we know all of these things now. And so there's kind of, it's not as collegial as it used to be, which means that we share more information. So there's good and bad.
Right. Well, one of the things that I found, you know, interesting in your book, Gary, is that you give a lot of inside account about how the strategies were developed and so forth. And when I first read it, my first instinct was, my God, you know, the legal profession must have changed substantially, because it seems like he's giving us, accounts of privileged conversations. Then I listened to your interview with Mike Arrington at the Computer Club in Silicon Valley, and I, you know, you explained that wasn't the case. But do you think that, I mean, it was a really candid account of how things happened. And I agree with, you know, Brandy, that that part of the information is a lot richer, it seems to me. Like, I can go online and there are lawyers talking about why they do things a certain way, which I don't think that they would have done so openly 10 years ago. I mean, lawyers are very guarded as a rule. You're not, but...
Yeah, I had to be careful in writing the book because lawyers do work under different rules than other people do. And, I had to observe those rules. And so, for example, when I talked about discussions, I had to make sure that all parts of those discussions had been revealed on the public record someplace before I actually wrote about them. And that's what I did. But I was still able to give, I think, an insight that other people might not be able to get if you didn't practice law, and that you could get by reading the book.
Okay. Well, now let's pause once more while Denise tells us a little bit about our second show sponsor.
Hello there, it's Denise Howell checking in to thank our sponsor, GoToMeeting.com, and suggest that you go to GoToMeeting.com/Twill to get yourself a 30-day free trial of this great product. GoToMeeting.com is an amazing addition to your business toolbox. It enables you to have meetings online with a conversation with multiple people in multiple locations, all viewing the same computer screen, which you control. So you can give a presentation, you can share documents, you can collaborate, you can plan, you can brainstorm, anything you could do in a conference room, talking to folks across the table and looking at a projected screen or a computer screen, you can do on GoToMeeting without traveling and without the expense and inconvenience that involves. So please go get yourself a 30-day free trial of GoToMeeting at GoToMeeting.com/Twill. Ernie and the gang, take it away.
Thanks, Denise. I just want to say I use GoToMeeting all the time. It's a really great way to get together with people. I'm astonished at how easy it is to use, and it has actually transformed a significant part of my law practice. So I think what we should do at this point is, because this is a great discussion we've had so far, but I'd like to talk a little bit about the Google book settlement, because I know Gary has some interesting observations to make there. But before we do that, I want to let everyone know that, since Rick works at Google and obviously wouldn't be able to comment, we don't want to keep him tied down here and unproductive, and we want to let him get back to his busy job at Blogger. So we want to thank him for joining us and wish him well with his work at Blogger. Thanks, Rick. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Gary and Brandy, nice to meet you virtually, and I look forward to hearing the conversation when it goes up.
And how can people find you online?
Oh, on right. Rklau, R-K-L-A-U on Twitter, and my blog is at tins, T-I-N-S, .rklau.com. Bonus points for people who figure out what tins means.
It's a Matrix reference. I know.
Oh,
I know the answer.
You just blew it.
No. You got to give him a little help.
All right,
anyway,
guys.
Well, it was great to have you. Thanks for joining us. Take care. All right. Okay. So the Google book settlement. This was on my radar for a couple of weeks because I'd hear people talking about it, but I really couldn't figure out what the problem was, because I wasn't reading it closely, and I thought, well, you know, Google's a good company. Wasn't this all about Google just wanting to get these books and scan them, and they bought some fancy equipment, and they were taking on this, you know, Herculean job that nobody else seemed to be capable capable of or wanting to do? And so, you know, what was the big problem? I mean, I kind of like Google. They have a good mission statement. So, Gary, why don't you tell us, what is the problem?
Well, first, I kind of like Google, too. I mean, there's a lot of a local pride out here in everything that they've achieved. I've known Eric Schmidt forever. I think it's a great company, and I'd love to cheer for them. I just can't cheer for them in this particular context. You know, Ernie, you said you weren't paying attention to this thing, and frankly, I wasn't either, and not a lot of other people were. And I got interested in this because my agent suggested early this year, after my manuscript went to the publisher, that I take a look at the Google Book settlement and write an op-ed for Publishers Weekly. And so I took a look at it, and it really didn't look right to me. And so I started calling around to people who I knew were upset about it, like the head librarian at Harvard, like, you know, Pam Samuelson, the MacArthur Fellow at the University of California Law School. And I found a bunch of people who kind of were dispirited, and they weren't really connected in a good way, and I didn't think their voices would be heard. It turns out that there were a lot of people who were upset about the deal. More than 400 submissions were made to the court in New York. The vast majority of them, by some calculations, 90% were opposed to the deal. So what's this about? It now turns out to be very important. What's it about? Well, it's about the future of books and the future of libraries, and for that matter, the future of search engines. It's about a whole lot of very important things. First and foremost, books are going digital, just like everything else, like music. And just as music going digital opened a lot of content to a lot of us, that prospect exists for books. Right now, the price point for digital books is $9.99. It's a lot lower than conventional books. And people of the generations younger than me are very eager to use their new devices to be able to read books that way. So the question is, how's that going to be done? And the issue in the Google Book settlement is whether it was going to be done by one company, Google, or whether there's going to be competition in that space, so that a whole lot of companies will be able to compete, to drive price down, to drive quality up, so that libraries won't be subject to having a single supplier that can raise price at whim, those kinds of things. So that's what's at issue at the 50,000-foot level, Ernie.
Right. How about you, Brandy? I mean, was this something that was showing up on your radar screen, and what was your view of this?
Yeah, well, it's been on my radar a while, but as a copyright lawyer, I probably have different ideas about it. I'm not an antitrust lawyer. And there's great people on both sides working on the issue. But in terms of the settlement itself, I think that it's, without going to a slippery slope argument, I think it's clear that indexing and making books available is good for society at large, right? The problem with the settlement, I think, I have some reservations about how the settlement works, that it really should be reserved for Congress to resolve in a legislative fashion. The DOJ seems like they're going to let that one slide, right? And so does the court. But I foresee some problems in the future from objectors appealing the settlement.
Right. Well, there was recently, and you pointed to this, there was recently an order entered, I don't know, yesterday by Judge Chin?
Yesterday, Judge Chin authorized they're delaying the hearing on the settlement because they're renegotiating it. They're throwing it out. And so some antitrust things are being renegotiated, like Google's exclusivity over licensing for 10 years. I think that will be thrown out. I think probably the class needs to come back as a narrower class. I think the class might be too large. I would like to see the notice period be done again, right? Notice period's already over. So if you're an author and you haven't opted out, it's pretty much too late. You can tell the registry not to sell your books or whatever, but it's too late to opt out of the settlement. And I think there's more that Google could do in terms of notice, right? You know, Google could have a very special message from Google on all the pages it serves, right? This is a huge settlement that affects all the authors and publishers in the world. And there's other nations that have problems with that. Authors, copyright owners from other nations, their copyright rights are governed by international treaty and not just by American law. So there's a lot of problems with the settlement as it is now. And I expect a lot of them to be hashed out, but I expect some of them to be hashed out in the courts afterwards.
You know, one of the things go ahead, Gary.
Well, I was going to say there's a strong sentiment along the lines that Brandy is indicating. We know now that the antitrust division of the Department of Justice is involved, and so at least some of the antitrust issues will get treatment. But Brandy's raising the issue of what the role of Congress should be here. There were congressional hearings just a week or so ago at which the Register of Copyrights, Mary Beth Peters, appeared as a witness. And she was practically pounding the table, saying that this whole structure is illegal, that this is not the kind of thing that should be done through private litigation. It's really a public issue, along the lines of what Brandy's saying, that there's so many interests implicated that they can't fairly be balanced by a court, and that's what Congress is supposed to do.
And so, on the same note as that, Muchnick, the objector in the Reed Elsevier case that's up for a Supreme Court review right now, he wrote the DOJ this morning asking for some bizarre thing, like the negotiations to be merged with the Reed Elsevier case, that there's not enough input from a variety of sources. And it just speaks to the problem that this is a legislative issue. My concerns about this aren't necessarily that I in particular don't want to see this happen because I think it's legislative. I think it's a problem that needs to be focused on. The DOJ has said, yeah, it's kind of a thing for Congress. And people like James Grumman at New York Law School have said, yeah, the court needs to look at this. But no one's really said a lot about this issue besides Mary Beth. And I'd like to see it explored more in the settlement.
Yeah.
Or by the court.
But certainly foreign authors have said a lot along the lines of what you're suggesting. I mean, the governments of both France and Germany filed oppositions in the Federal District Court in New York. So I think there's certainly a lot of sentiment along the lines that you suggest. How the court will factor that in, that part I agree with you, is not clear. Also sentiment.
The court really wants to factor that in, right? It's a question of judicial power, and the court may not look at it at all. Which is understandable, and it's interesting from our point of view, and maybe reviewed later. Certainly, there are members of the Supreme Court who would have, raised issue with, judicial lawmaking like this, which I'm not afraid to characterize it as such.
Yeah, I don't think that I wouldn't throw the towel in on that one in the district court. I mean, what I'm told about this judge, and I've never appeared before him personally, is that he is a very prudent guy. Now, as you know, he's been nominated for the Second Circuit. And so how long he continues to have this case is an open question. But the issue of this being kind of legislating from the bench is right up there. And in the congressional hearings where Mary Beth appeared, one of the questioners was the head of the House Antitrust Committee, a congressman from the greater Atlanta area, and he said almost exactly the same thing that you've said here. So I don't know that the judge is going to ignore those issues. I would be disheartened if he did. I mean, I'm most interested in the antitrust issues, and I think there are serious problems there. But if we're going to have a digital library in the future, if we're going to have digital books, we're going to have to sort all these questions out, not just the antitrust questions, and certainly not just some of the antitrust questions. We're going to have to come to grips with a lot of these important issues. And you may well be right. There's certainly a lot of sentiment in my group. It's a group called the Open Book Alliance. It includes libraries and writers groups and small publishers and commercial groups. And some of them feel exactly the same way you do, that this really ought to be in Congress and shouldn't be in the court at all. So I wouldn't give up hope on that one.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, small publishers and other parts of the copyright industry haven't always been as well represented as they would like to be in the legislature. So I can see it from both ways. I do think that Judge Chin is likely to approve it. I think he tipped his hat as much in yesterday's order that basically he thinks it's good for society. And as long as the parties can, I don't remember his words. I'm not going to put words in the judge's mouth, but I think he's likely to approve it. as long as the DOJ signs off. And I don't think the DOJ is hitting on this Article 1 issue very much. But there's other problems with the settlement, not least of which is privacy, reader privacy. It's huge. For the average American, it's a huge issue. And while there's a lot of goods being created from Google Book Search, like metadata and the databases for researchers to work with, where, you know, we're going to have these amazing language databases that have never been generated before. We don't want the same thing to happen to our reading records, right? We don't necessarily want researchers to have access to those because we know that firms have already shown through anonymous data they can find out who we are, right?
Well, it seems like that all of those are really great questions, and those are things that should be vigorously debated. And it seems to me that a lawsuit is not a place where those kinds of issues can be efficiently debated. But I have another concern, and maybe I wasn't paying attention to this, but when I started reading about how this kind of blew up, it struck me that there was a weird use of the class action procedure here. And last week, Doug railed out against it and said this is the most egregious use of class action procedure. And, elucidate this for us, Gary, but it seemed like what happened was certain interested parties who had limited interests came in, said, okay, we sue, there's that lawsuit. Then they're going to reach a settlement. And now all of a sudden, there are all these other interests that those parties who initiated the suit to begin with weren't interested in, which are now going to be adjudicated. Is that true?
Yeah, unfortunately. Now, that's what hasn't been decided yet. This hearing that was postponed was to decide whether the class should be certified. But basically what's happened is there was a private lawsuit between Google and five big New York publishers. And it was over, as Brandy indicated, whether Google could create a card catalog, not a library, but whether Google could index books. And if you went on to Google, it would show you the closest library, show you the closest bookstore, show you websites where you could get those books. At the last minute, after 3 years of secret negotiation, all that changed. And the settlement now, which is proposed as a class action, purports to control every copyright, every U.S. copyright still pending, from the beginning of the Republic to the beginning of this year. And since
registered,
most
though.
Foreign works also – yeah. But since most foreign works or many foreign works have U.S. registration, it also implicates foreign publishers and foreign authors. It implicates academics who really don't want the same kind of control over their works that say, fiction authors do. I mean, it is, I think, a stretch to use class action in this way. And in the brief that I filed, I call it a contrivance, an effort to sort of get more than the lawsuit was about in the first place. It is highly unusual. I've never seen anything like this before. And I, too, on that one, I have to agree with Brandy. I'm surprised the judge didn't comment on that. Now, maybe he didn't feel that he had to comment on everything, but there's several aspects of the judge just sort of issued a little note, and we don't know exactly what he thinks on all these issues, but certainly that class issue has to be right up there, and the privacy issue, too. You know, that wasn't mentioned. The Department of Justice doesn't really have jurisdiction over that, but the Federal Trade Commission does, and they have submitted a comment to the court, and as you all know, the EFF and other groups have weighed in on this issue, and that has to be decided as well. So there are really a lot of issues. I think that, Ernie, you raise a good point. Given the breadth of all this, should this be done in a piece of what is private litigation, basically? Now, there is a sentiment by librarians, certainly by Google, by some other people, hey, we've got this asset. We're on the cusp of having this wonderful digital library. Can't we get it out there? Why can't – hey, I find there's some problems. Hey, a little monopoly here and there, a little invasion of privacy. What's a big deal? let's just get it out there, and people will use it, and it'll be great. Well,
here's my slippery slope on the use of the class action in this way, and it's kind of playing off something that Ernie sent around, except more dark and evil. Say that Google decided it was a good idea that it should index all the world's medical information and make it publicly accessible and searchable, right? Well, privacy law, it's a mixture of state and federal, but we're just going to ignore that. But privacy law says, you know, we can't really do that. But if we can gin up a lawsuit and get Google to collude with some class representatives that they'll agree that all the privacy, all the medical information in the past can be indexed and copied and made public, well, that is good for society at whole, right? You know, maybe we could cure cancer if we did that. But for individuals, it's clearly, you know, detrimental. Maybe I'm trying to get a job and I can't because I have a pre-existing condition of some sort. So that's my slippery slope on using the class action in this way. I don't think that's necessarily true of this particular one, but I have concerns about using class action in this way. The other point I wanted to make in getting around this issue, is it legislative? Is it not legislative? The Supreme Court has already said it is generally up to Congress to decide such matters. And I think generally is a really strong proviso here. So in instances where the need is so great and Congress has failed to act, as they have failed to act right now, in taking years and years on Orphan Works legislation when it's been before them for years and years, then the public benefit is so large, maybe the court will act, you know, or decide that it's not for the legislature if they fail to act. And of course, Congress can also legislate in the area afterwards and may change the playing field again.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I hope that they do. I mean, I hope that all of this, you know, people get, you know, start paying more attention, you know, if we can, we lawyers can pay attention, then everybody should pay attention too. And Gary, you're doing a great job raising awareness, and we need to wrap up. So I want to kind of wind things down here and just tell you that I really have appreciated having you on the show. I wish we could go on forever because I know people would love to hear more about this very thorny issue from both of you guys. But, you know, thank you, Brandy, for being on the show. It's great to have you as well.
Thank you.
Tell everyone where we can find you online.
On Twitter at Brandy K, BrandyK. And website is brandycarl.com. I've been off of Twitter for a little bit because my iPhone was dead, but now it's back.
So all right. Well,
I'm back too.
But we'll all be following you and keeping up to date with you and what's going on. Great to have you.
Okay,
Gary, great to have you too. I really enjoy this very much. I wish this could go on forever. I highly recommend your book. I'm serious. I think it's just an amazing piece of work. I really enjoyed it. In fact, I started reading it again to prepare for this meeting, and I got totally absorbed. The Borland case, it's just absolutely fascinating. So you've done a really good job, and I hope more people read it. Maybe you should get onto Audible and dictate it yourself. You know, Jeffrey Toobin did that with his book, The Nine, and did a great job.
Yeah.
So great to have you.
You could have a wiki audiobook. Sorry.
There you go. So you're at GaryReback.com. You're not on Twitter yet, I take it, right?
No, I just can't handle that given the load of the case right now.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. And thank you all for joining us. And remember that next week we'll be live again on Friday at 11 o'clock a.m. Pacific time and 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. So till then, thank you all very much for joining us. And this is another episode of This Week in Law wrapping up.